Warning, this podcast details firsthand accounts of graphic crime, as well as deeply disturbing emotional profiles, and may not be suitable for all listeners. Please proceed with caution.
Molasses Manifesto.
Bayside, Queens. A guy and a girl were wounded there, no one was killed. This is the sixth night one, right?
So.
No, something's wrong. This one.
Yes, sixth is in the Bronx, two people killed.
Yeah, that's right. I lost track myself.
A Molasses Manifesto production brought to you by Audio Up. You're listening to Killer Tape, the true crime podcast where killers and hardcore criminals tell their own story in their own words. I'm your host, documentary filmmaker Bill Badgley. Joining me is veteran prison reporter Jack Jones. This is Killer Tape, Season 1, David Berkowitz, a.k.a. the Son of Sam.
I hope you die.
He confessed to being the 44 killer, ordered by a voice speaking through a neighbor's dog, carry out his bloody outrages against young pretty women.
I snuck up on him and shot him.
Berkowitz planned to use the revolver again and again until he felt police were getting close.
I wanted to help people. I wanted to be important to somebody, you understand?
David Berkowitz, 24 years old, found himself surrounded by police. Well, he said, you got me.
And now the need for a story, if not for anybody else, for myself.
Police say those words ended the biggest manhunt in New York City history.
I should spend my whole life here for what I've done.
Episode 16, A Curiosity About Death. Act 1, Judy Placido and Salvatore Lupo.
That was in June of 77, in Bayside, Queens.
A guy and a girl were wounded there, no one was killed.
Robert Lane, kind of thing?
Yeah, behind the discotheque.
About what time was
that? 2:30 in the morning.
Car windows open, or just got inside the car, or through the window?
Shot right through the window.
Oh, sorry.
Side, passenger side.
This was on the parking lot then, behind the disco?
It was on a side street.
Same thing, did you rode a bike and park several blocks away?
I was
walking.
I was walking. My car was several blocks away, but I was walking.
Anything at all was different about that one?
No. We're all the same here. Remarkably similar.
Did you live in Uptown?
No.
On June 24th, 1977, after an absolutely sweltering day of heat and humidity had more or less come to a close, David Berkowitz put on a baggy denim shirt, jeans, and old work boots, slipped the .44 into a paper bag, and headed out the door. Quote, I ran downstairs to my car. It was cooler in the early evening. The fresh air always seemed to clear my mind. End quote. Again, he took the Bronx Whitestone Bridge into Queens, where, after turning onto Northern Boulevard, entered the neighborhood of Bayside. As he passed a disco called the Eliphas, David noticed a red Cadillac parked on a side street. There were two people inside, and one was a girl. Quote, I saw her long hair. I looked around. The street was deserted. I then began to approach the car from the rear, keeping just behind the right rear fender. When I reached the car's trunk, I stopped to get out the gun. Then I stepped onto the curb and took a few steps forward, which brought me directly in front of the passenger's side. I could see them clearly in the front seat. The window was closed. They weren't looking in my direction. I crouched down to bring myself level with the girl and fired. End quote. Here's our series producer, Allison Baker.
Slim with long brown hair, Judy Placido was 17 years old when she celebrated her graduation from Catherine's Academy with her family on the evening of June 25th, 1977. Judy's family had been through a lot in a short period of time, but everyone who could be there was there to support her. Judy's mother had died 9 years earlier. Judy had been living with her Aunt Judith and her grandmother, Dominica, since 1972 when her father, Aldo, remarried. Her older brother, John, and sister, Donna, were grown and out of the house, but had returned to celebrate Judy's graduation at the family home in Pelham Gardens in the northeast section of the Bronx. Everyone was excited and rallied around Judy, who was looking forward to starting college at Pace University in the fall. As the party died down around 9:30 p.m., Judy picked up the phone to call her friends Angela Delfino, Debbie Volpe, and Antoinette Coiro. Despite it being a damp and rainy night, Judy wanted to continue the festivities with her girlfriends and suggested they swing by the popular local disco, Elifuzz. There had been some concern amongst the group about the recent Son of Sam killings, but the girls felt that the rainy weather would keep him off the streets. Angela picked everyone up in her blue Buick Regal, and they headed 9 miles south to Elifuzz in Bayside, Queens. She found a parking spot a few blocks away. Tony C was the DJ. Neon lights reflected off the wet streets as the girls walked towards the club. Once inside, they headed towards the bar and ordered a round of drinks. They noticed the turnout was light, but as the hours clicked by, the dance floor began to fill up. 20-year-old Salvatore Lupo, known to his friends as Sal, often hung out at Elifuzz, where his friend Ralph Sacente was the bouncer. One of seven children, Sal worked at a service station owned by his brother and lived further west in the neighborhood of Maspeth, Queens. On the night of June 25th, Ralph was scheduled to work, so Sal decided to join him on the drive-in and hang out until Ralph's shift was over. Ralph worked the door while Sal was inside enjoying the perks of being friends with the staff, free drinks. Meanwhile, Judy, Debbie, Antoinette, and Angela were busy on the dance floor. It was 11 p.m. Judy spotted Sal and called him over to help get rid of a guy who was bothering her. Sal played along and the two wound up dancing in conversation until roughly 2 a.m. Debbie, Antoinette, and Angela were feeling ready to head home and came over to Judy and Sal to let them know. Judy wasn't quite ready, so Sal offered to take her home in Ralph's car. As her friend said goodnight, Judy couldn't help but think about being left behind with a killer on the loose. At 3 a.m., Ralph's shift was about over. He tossed Sal his car keys and said he would be out in about 10 minutes. Judy and Sal headed outside, discussing the .44 caliber killer as they walked down the early morning streets towards Ralph's Cadillac. Conversation about the killer continued as they climbed into the car and closed the door. Suddenly, from out of nowhere, there was a crash. The deafening blast sent Judy and Sal into a panic. Sal opened the car door and saw his arm covered in blood. He had been shot. Completely disoriented, Sal left Judy in the car and ran into the disco for help. Judy, in a hazy state of shock, noticed her reflection in the rearview mirror. She was covered in blood. Unable to move her right arm, she reached over and opened the passenger side door with her left arm and stumbled out of the car. Judy began screaming for help and collapsed a block away from Elifuzz. She felt a bump on her head, not knowing it was a bullet. Judy had been shot 3 times, once through the back of her neck, leaving behind permanent bullet fragments, once in the back of her right shoulder, and once in the right temple. Miraculously, she wasn't killed. Judy and Sal were rushed to Flushing Hospital. They both survived and eventually recovered.
The attack on Judy Placido and Sal Lupo was Berkowitz's 7th attack with the .44, and coincidentally, the one he was most embarrassed of, due to the very public lack of a homicide, about which he, of course, had an excuse. Quote, "The window deflected the bullet. It wouldn't go through the window right. I mean, I tried," end quote. David Berkowitz was no longer acting in secret. He was a star now, and the eyes of the world were upon him, which meant that he had missed while everyone was watching. And about this, he was pretty upset. I mean, he had, in his mind, done everything right. Quote, "Two were wounded and I was angry. I didn't see how that girl lived. Again, I had no fear. I was alert and cautious. I ran to my car only as to escape, and I cunningly traveled up 35th Avenue and not the main road, Northern Boulevard. This shooting was done close to my sister's house," end quote. Despite having lived, Judy was still terribly hurt, saying later, quote,
"I was injured near the temple and near the spinal cord and in my right shoulder, yet I was able to run. But at the time, I had no idea what happened. I didn't even know that I had been shot. I didn't think for a second that I had been shot by the .44 caliber killer."
After the murder, Berkowitz, in customary fashion, ran away from the scene, heading east down Northern Boulevard, turning right at 211th Street. When he reached the car, he cranked it up and got out of there. As he sped away, he passed a squad car on the Clearview Access Road. But Berkowitz, considering himself to be some kind of a phantom at this point, invisible to police and impervious to arrest, remained calm and drove right by. Act 2. Death is a Friend of Mine. As New York City was busy falling all over itself trying to find the lone gunman known as the Son of Sam, David Berkowitz was busy with his lifelong, sad sack, woe is me type fascination with death, just as he always had been. Quote, I do love death. I've always loved it. I've wished for it and tried to understand it. Death is fascinating. Its power, its hold, it's fascinating. Death is a friend of mine. End quote. Jack asked David about his love of visiting the cemetery.
The paradox continues to abound in this thing. I was thinking that on one hand you were out with emergency equipment to help save lives, and you had a gun to take lives. You would go to cemeteries and mourn over the graves of people who had died at an early age.
Yeah.
And kind of clean up their graves and stuff like that. Did you envy the people who were at the cemetery? Was that part of your death wish?
I suppose it was, yeah.
I have to go back to his childhood again, where his grandfather's death was the biggest event, next to his mother's death a few years later, that he recalled as being fascinated by. He talked about visiting his mother's and his grandfather's graves as kind of like some kids might talk about a day at the zoo or going to the park or something.
When did you start visiting cemeteries?
Actually, my adopted mother started. She used to do that. When we went to my grandfather's cemetery, we used to go sometimes. My uncle used to do it too, and he's still alive, my Uncle Lou. We used to go around to some of the graves and just look up names and stuff, you know, see when these people died.
What kind of comments did people make, like, boy, there's a young one, or he didn't last?
I don't remember that, but I remember we used to go around to the different graves. Maybe their interest was just to look at the different headstones because they had all types of designs and things, you know. I don't know. Some of the stones were real fancy. Others were just covered over with weeds and laying on one side, you know, unkept and not cared for it. Maybe they just wanted to see the headstones, but they seemed to pay a lot of attention, what I can remember, to the names and things. And I just carried that over. I developed an interest in it, you know. Especially since I was always an unhappy child, and one who was always depressed and things, or angry, at, you know, had a lot of aggressive tendencies directed towards my parents, the school, or society, you know. I guess I had more of a curiosity than most people. I don't know. It's hard to explain.
What David Berkowitz's adoptive mother Pearl had done, likely out of the healthy sense of curiosity / adventure, David continued to do on his own, attaching to it a deep and dark significance of his own design.
You said you went to the cemeteries with your mother first. When did you start going back on your own?
When I was a teenager, I started to take walks to Mount Vernon. When I got a car, when I visited my mother's cemetery, I started to walk around, you know.
After Pearl's passing in 1967, the cemetery they had once visited together, mother and son, was now the place where he visited her, the place she occupied. Death and love had been combined. The only shred of love and acceptance he had ever known had been quite literally put in the ground and covered with dirt. Quote, I go to her grave all the time. Since Dad remarried, he never goes to her grave. I resent it. I went 4 or 5 times a year and cleaned up her grave, end quote. And while he was there, involved in what seemed on the surface a rather innocuous activity, David Berkowitz began visiting the headstones of absolute strangers, and he did it for reasons that were all his own. Quote, every 4 months or so, on Sunday mornings for a ride, I just used to have the urge to go, just hang around, talk. I used to visit all the graves there. I knew a couple. I don't remember the names. I used to have paper and mark down at what spots the people I wanted to visit were buried. Mostly young girls. A lot of young girls buried there, and some young kids, young guys. I would, you know, talk. They couldn't hear, I don't think. They were teenagers, young 20s. I don't know how they died. I always wanted to find out. I'm curious. Was it a car accident? A disease? It always intrigued me. The graves near where my mother's is, I felt like I knew the people buried there. People I have never seen. Girls that were there. Whether they were pretty, I wanted to know. I felt akin to them. Everybody mourns more for pretty girls, more than the ugly. Pretty girls always get more attention in life. Guys lay down their lives for them. End quote. Incredibly shallow feelings about beauty aside, alone at the graveyard, David Berkowitz was relating to his peers. Not by reaching out to them in life, of course, but by reaching out to them in death.
We humans seem to be the only species on the planet who can even conceptualize our own death. There are people who read and reread these novels of terror and death and mayhem. They deal with it that way. Maybe a few visit cemeteries, but I don't think there are many who visit as serial killers the way that David Berkowitz did.
David Berkowitz was bonding with the dead. I mean, after all, they had what he always wanted. They were dead and he was jealous. And beyond that, the practice fed on his melancholy and festered his depression, making everything he had always felt seem so appropriate, even warranted.
I felt akin to these people who died, you know. I felt sorry for people who died, especially in the prime of life, you know, when they didn't have a chance to live. You know, here I am, a person who wanted to die, who was longing to die, and here were these young people who died against their wills, you know, in accidents or sickness and disease. I felt a kinship with them, so that I would go around to the cemeteries, you know, and like lay flowers at their graves and just clean up, rearrange the graves neatly, you know.
These are people you didn't even know.
Didn't even know, you know.
It was, as they say, a way to make friends and influence people. And it was a hell of a lot safer than risking the possibility of being rejected in an actual one-on-one face-to-face interaction. It was exactly the kind of one-sided interface he had always preferred. And he felt, in terms of his death fantasy at least, that he was very much not alone in this.
There's always a morbid curiosity about death because everybody knows they'll have to die one day. And they're curious about it.
Yeah.
Everybody's got this morbid satisfaction, but you see, they don't even realize it. They crowd around scenes of accidents, you know, police have the area roped off, a car went out of control, plowed into a few people standing on a street corner, and the next thing you know, the whole shopping area is filled with pedestrians trying to get a peek, you know. And, you know, wow, you know, there's just nothing there to see, but some people have come, you know, blankets covered over them, you know, and just their feet and their hands sticking out, and you have people there, you know.
Yeah, vultures.
You know what I'm saying? And yeah, but I think most people are like that. I remember there was a police officer shot in on 42nd Street, Manhattan, and I saw pictures of it. They had a few police vehicles outside the store where he was shot, you know, trying to chase a bank robber. The whole street was jammed up with just bystanders trying to get a peek, you know. And this is all morbid curiosity or something, you know. And people aren't even aware of this. Most of it is unconscious, you know. They just go where the accident is. Yeah, either people are frightened of it or they're curious, you know. They want to relieve their fears by being curious, you know.
Wanting so desperately to be normal, David reaches out to the similarities he sees between himself and others, namely his fascination with death and everything related.
I see a lot of people... husbands who've lost their wives and wives who've lost their husbands going on as if that person was still alive. Like my grandmother and my grandfather were very close. My grandfather died when I was young, and my grandmother is still alive today, and she's in her 90s. Yet his bed, which he hasn't slept on in about 15 or 20 years because he died, is perfectly kept, and she keeps it there, and she keeps all his clothes and all his trinkets in the box, the tie clips, and all these... all this old stuff, you know, his old jewelry.
and furniture. As if you'd walk into the house not knowing the situation, you'd think the two people live there, you know. Yet she lives in that apartment alone. So it's not really abnormal, I think, for people to continue their lives as if that other person who died is still alive or tries to talk to them, you know.
See, everyone lives with the dead, not just me. And sometimes, just as I do, they commune with them.
People often hold conversations with people that died, you know, hoping that they could hear. They pray over their graves. My father did this when, like, my mother died. My father, my adoptive mother and father are very, very close. It was only the three of us, you know, in the family. And when he went over to the grave, after we'd be there for a while, he'd tell me to walk away, and then he'd be there. I'd see him crying and talking, you know. You understand what I'm saying?
Visiting the cemetery in the exact manner for which it was intended, David's adoptive father, Nat, used it as a place to engage with his own unresolved emotions for the purposes of closure. But that's not what David was using it for. David was using it as a place to court girls and hang out with friends, a place to hold a current relationship, not to sort out feelings associated with one in the past. And he did this in lieu of seeking out others in the world around him. And of course, not to lose sight of the bigger picture here, problem with that was, David wasn't just visiting people in the cemetery, he was sending them there. And to make things even stranger, once he started doing that, he set about making plans to visit them. Let the circle be unbroken, I guess.
After he began killing people, he returned to the final resting place of his victims to allegedly mourn, but it seemed like also to gloat over the fact that he was the agent of their deaths.
You mentioned that you tried to find the graves of one of your victims.
Yeah.
At one time.
Wanted to somehow communicate with them, you know. So there'd be no hard feelings or something. I hesitate to say it because it sounds so bizarre, and someone's like, will think, oh, this guy's nuts, you know. But it's not really. I think a lot of people do that, you know, trying to, you know, communicate with somebody that's gone on and died or something.
David Berkowitz just wanted to say he was sorry.
He got some kind of morbid, you know, again, perhaps even necrophiliac satisfaction from visiting the graves of his biological mother and of his victims and others. I mean, people go to cemeteries to pay respects to the lives of loved ones they've lost. But for him, it was a way to maybe partially, legitimately come to grips with his own fears about death, but more so I think it was maybe a way to feed this darkness in himself and the sense of despair that he had felt as a child when his biological mother was totally knocked flat by his grandfather's death.
David Berkowitz wasn't done feeding that darkness, and he wasn't done killing either, not by a long shot. Act 3, Stacy Moskowitz and Bobby Violante.
The eighth was in Brooklyn, New York. It was the first time in Brooklyn, and that was the Moskowitz shooting. Well, she was killed, a girl, and the guy was wounded pretty bad.
Were they in the
Yeah, also in a lover's lane type setting.
On July 31st, 1977, 19-year-old Tommy Zeno and his 17-year-old date, Debbie Krasinko, were parked under a street lamp on Bay 17th Street in Tommy's powder blue Corvette. Well, it wasn't exactly Tommy's. He borrowed it from one of the guys at the body shop, where he was a part owner, in order to impress his date, Debbie. Debbie's parents, for their part, had urged her not to go, saying, quote, "The killer didn't strike yesterday, on the anniversary of the first killing, as the newspaper said he would. Maybe he'll wait until tonight," end quote. And they were right. The whole city had been bracing itself for an attack on the preceding day, July 29th, 1977, which had marked the one-year anniversary of the murder of Donna Loria, the first of David's attacks with the .44. When no such attack had occurred, the entire city, specifically its young people, felt a momentary sigh of relief, and with it, perhaps, some permission to live life as normal for a change. And so it was that Debbie Krasinko found herself in a parked car on a deserted road in the middle of the night under a street lamp. Feeling a little too on display under said street lamp, Debbie urged her date to move the car, which he did. As he did, a pair of headlights moved into the space they had just left. The couple inside that car were Stacy Moskowitz and Bobby Violante. It was 2:15 a.m. Earlier that same evening, David Berkowitz put on work boots, jeans, and a denim shirt, grabbed the .44, and left his apartment. This time, instead of heading to Queens, he drove out to Long Island. Quote, "I purposely drove out to Long Island to kill someone. It didn't matter who I kill, whoever I'd come across," end quote. But after a few hours of driving around aimlessly, it proved of no use, so he left and headed into Brooklyn, where he arrived around 1:50 a.m. in the South Shore neighborhood of Bensonhurst. Quote, "I'd driven all the way through Queens and out to Huntington, then back to the South Shore along the streets of Brooklyn. When I got to Bay 17th, I knew I had the right spot," end quote. David walked the Greenbelt until he reached the shore road. It was then David saw the powder blue Corvette parked under the street lamp. Deciding the hapless pair inside would be his next victims, he approached the car and reached for the gun. As he did, the car cranked up and started to roll forward. David froze. Quote, "I wasn't sure that they had seen me. I couldn't move, so I just stood there waiting for someone to get out and scream at me, but nothing happened. Only the car just began to move. I turned away and walked along the street alongside the parkway. When I looked back, the sports car was about 50 feet further away. I didn't know what to do. Should I follow them or shouldn't I?" End quote. As Berkowitz deliberated, another car pulled into the parking space beneath the street lamp. Seeing this as a sign, David again approached. Quote, "I walked straight to the car. When I got to the rear of it, I looked around and then stepped onto the sidewalk. I moved right to the driver's side and pulled out the gun. I didn't care if anyone saw me. It didn't matter. I had to shoot them," end quote. Here's our series producer, Allison Baker.
20-year-old Stacy Moskowitz, petite with bleach blonde hair, lived with her younger sister Ricky and their parents in a second-floor flat at 1740 East 5th Street in Brooklyn. Their father, Jerry, worked long hours as a delivery man for the Dolly Madison Ice Cream Company, and their mother, Nasa, was a stay-at-home mom. Stacy had an interest in fashion, and after graduating from Adelphi Business School, accepted a position as a color coordinator in a shoe manufacturing firm, the Empire State Building. On the night of Thursday, June 28th, Stacy and Ricky were headed to Beefsteak Charlie's, a popular Brooklyn restaurant. The room was buzzing as they made their way through the crowd to a table. Once they sat down, Ricky noticed a dark-haired guy walking towards them. He introduced himself and asked if he could join them. His name was Bobby Violante. 20 years old, tall and good-looking, Bobby had recently signed a contract with the Wilhelmina Modeling Agency while on summer break from his job in the menswear business. He lived nearby with his parents in the Bensonhurst neighborhood of Brooklyn. Bobby had originally been interested in Ricky, but as Bobby and Stacy began chatting, it was clear they had the most in common. The chemistry between them grew as they spoke, and when the night came to a close, Stacy wrote down her number and passed it to Bobby. They made plans to meet up for a date two nights later. On Saturday, July 30th, Stacy spent the afternoon shopping with her grandmother and talking excitedly about Bobby. When she got home, she rushed up the stairs with her shopping bag into her bedroom and started to get ready. Shortly after, Bobby arrived, parking his father's 1969 blue Buick Skylark out front. He rang the Moskowitz's apartment number to get in the building. Bobby was buzzed into the building and greeted at the apartment door by Nasa, who invited him in to have a seat on the couch and wait for Stacy. Stacy's father, Jerry, extended his hand to a slightly uncomfortable Bobby and joined him on the couch for a quick chat. Soon, Stacy walked in and sat down with Bobby and her parents. Nasa and Jerry warned them to be aware that the .44 caliber killer was still roaming the streets and to be very careful. Bobby and Stacy assured them that they would, said their goodbyes, and Nasa and Jerry went out to the patio to watch them drive off. The couple decided to see New York, New York at the Kingsway Theater. They arrived to find the theater was nearly empty as people stayed home fearing the .44 caliber killer who was terrorizing the city. After the movie ended, Stacy and Bobby went for a bite to eat at a nearby diner, then decided to drop by Jasmine's, a local nightclub. They had only stayed for 40 minutes as the club, like others that weekend, felt a little desolate and empty. Not ready for the night to end, they decided to make the short drive to Gravesend Bay to watch the ships go by. Bobby pulled into a parking space under a street lamp on Bay 17th Street and turned off the engine. The couple got out and strolled to a nearby park. It was close to 2:30 a.m. as Stacy sat down on the swings, Bobby holding her tight. After a few minutes, they noticed a man lurking in the shadows, wearing a jean jacket, leaning up against a park house with his arms folded. They stayed for a few minutes, but Stacy felt creeped out and told Bobby she wanted to leave. On the walk back to the car, Bobby noticed the man who had been leaning against the park house was no longer there. They climbed in and instead of driving off, sat and talked. Suddenly, the car window exploded. Everything went black. Bobby woke seconds later to a loud humming inside his head and screamed out, "Oh my God, oh my God, he killed us." Bobby realized he was still alive when he heard the faint moaning of Stacy next to him. Having been shot twice in the face, he couldn't see that Stacy, limp in her seat, had also been shot in the head. Bobby slammed his hand repeatedly on the horn, felt around for the door handle, and tumbled out of the car. With his hands over his blood-soaked face, he shouted out for help until he collapsed in the street. Bobby's screams had been heard by neighbors, and within minutes, a slew of police cars screeched up to find Bobby lying on the ground by the car and Stacy in the passenger seat mumbling, with a gunshot wound in the back of her head. An ambulance arrived and rushed them to Kings County Hospital.
Quote, "I parked my car at Bay 17, got out and walked around the neighborhood for 10 minutes. I saw her and her boyfriend making out in the car. Then they left the car, went over the walk bridge, and went along the path by the water. After about 20 minutes, they returned to the car, made out some more, then came to where I was by the swings. I watched Stacy on the swing, and then they stopped swinging. Her and her date then started to kiss passionately for several minutes. At this time, I too was sexually aroused. Shortly after the deep kissing, they went back to the car. If my memory is correct, they made out a little more and then just sat inside the car talking. I had my gun out, aimed at the middle of Stacy's head, and fired. One bullet struck her head and another nicked her. I didn't even know she was shot because she didn't say anything, nor did she moan. I shot the last three times at the both of them. I really wanted the girl more than anything. I don't know why I shot the guy, but they were so close together, then I got in my car and drove off. I simply drove northeast on 18th Avenue as far as it went. It was a pretty big street. I could see that it went pretty far. I wasn't going any place in particular." End quote. On the way home, Berkowitz drove around Prospect Park, then stopped at a newsstand and bought a paper, at which point he decided to drive back to the Verrazano Bridge, where he sat on a park bench and waited for the sun to come up. He was less than a mile from where he had shot Stacy Moskowitz and Bobby Violante. After he finished the paper, he crossed the Williamsburg Bridge back into Manhattan, somehow undetected by the bridge patrols that had started around 3:30 a.m. that morning. Years later, in prison, David's psychiatrist asked him how he felt that night. Question, were you afraid to be discovered? Answer, I didn't want to be discovered. Question, why? Answer, I had more killings to do. Jack asked David about events that had transpired shortly before the attack.
Now that's the one where you said you had seen the cops ticketing the cars.
Yeah, right. That was the final one. I guess the most dramatic from the point of view of the people, because that's where everything fell into, place where I was arrested.
Someone also saw you walking.
Yeah, right. A woman saw me walking around the neighborhood.
You said you saw the police cars ticketing before you parked, or after you came back?
I was walking, my car was already parked, and I was walking through the neighborhood. And when I was walking to my car, you know, there are these garden apartments, and in between them is very poorly lit. So I was coming out, and I just noticed, I was coming out of the walkway, going to my car, or just passing, you know, I had spotted the two police ticketing their car. So they were already there. I didn't see them earlier.
Shortly before what would be David Berkowitz's final murder, he had seen the police writing him a ticket, then went ahead with the attack anyway.
You said you saw the cop there writing tickets?
Yeah.
So you parked there intentionally?
Well, I parked there, right, by the fire hydrant, and I saw a police car cruising up the block. And the police car stopped alongside my car, but a little to the back, you know. One of the cops got out. The other guy was sitting in the car. I stood across the street in a darkened spot. I was walking towards the car. I was about to go to my car, but I saw them there, you see. And one guy wrote out a ticket and just put it on my window. And then they, you know, it's a standard procedure. They don't pay attention. They just look at the car and write the ticket and drive off. They drove up the block. And there were some other double parked cars there, so they gave out a few tickets there. And then I guess they finished and went on their way. And about 45 minutes later or so, the shooting happened. And, you know, I saw that, well, I've got the ticket. Now they're going to have to come as a standard procedure to, they're going to have to come my way, which is exactly what happened.
According to him, he parked there intentionally and allowed himself to be ticketed at near a crime scene that was for a murder he was preparing to commit, hoping that it would lead to his arrest finally.
Did you really want to be caught at that time?
Yeah. Well, not at that time. I had like a guilty feelings, but I was trying to suppress them with this demon thing. It was just getting underway, you know. But I didn't let the guilt show. I just kept it in me. Eventually it came out, and I arranged for myself to get caught, you see.
Okay, you arranged for yourself to get caught.
Mm-hmm.
Did you try to get caught before they actually nailed you?
I guess you could say I was leaving signs, hints, and things.
I think it was always in the back of his mind. He had the idea of Whitman and Taxi Driver, a grand finale, a big shootout, a blaze of glory, and probably realized, too, that the only way that he was going to stay alive would not be in a grand finale confrontation where he would be gunned down along with his victims, but would be to get caught quietly and peacefully and treated almost with courtesy.
David was, as he always had been, a pretty big scaredy cat. So if the guilt was getting to him and he was in fact yearning to be caught, then it was going to have to be on his terms. And that meant safely and sans confrontation, if at all possible.
He could have walked up to those police officers. He could have turned himself in at any time. But that would have been confronting something honestly. Everything he did was done obliquely. There wasn't a straight thought in his head or a straight bone in his morally insane psyche. This was a guy who chose to live in solitude and as much as possible at the edges of things, in the shadows, and move at cross angles to other people without ever confronting them face to face.
He's also a narcissist, so it's always about what he did or didn't do, or in this case, what he did or didn't know.
I'd read the police manuals, you know, what they do, you know, how they do it. So I had a couple of police manuals which I purchased at the police, you know, the bookstore. It's a store that sells police supplies in Long Island, Nassau County. It's very popular with all the local cops, and they all go there for supplies and things. And they got all these manuals for police work, you know. So I bought a couple to dealing with, you know, homicide and things and major crimes. And this was even a couple of years before the crime, you know, I started on the crime spree. And I knew that after I got this parking ticket that as a standard procedure, the police will check all, in order to find out who's been in the area, they'll check people who got tickets for
moving violations in the area, you know, or parking tickets sometime within the 24-hour period. Also, the police go up and down all the streets, copying down license plate numbers of all the cars parked there, see if there are any cars that would be, you know, out of place or something, you know, other than belonging to local residents that time of night. That's the only cars you'd really find in that area. And those are standard police procedures. So I knew that they'd come. It would only be a matter of time before the police worked their way to my address, because I never changed my license plate or anything. I always had my own license plate.
In addition to studying serial killers, David Berkowitz had also been studying the cops.
A lot of rapists and murderers and pedophiles and you name it are wannabe cops. They study for it. Many of them do work as volunteer assistant police officers or whatever.
According to David, being a student of police protocol, he had known what was going to happen. And again, according to him, had gone ahead and done it anyway in order to bring on his eventual capture in accordance to his own will. It was all up to him, as everything was. He was still the puppet master, controlling events, pulling the strings, and making everyone dance.
Did you just get careless on that parking ticket deal? Feel like you did that on purpose?
When I saw the cops there, I figured now's my chance. You know, because early, about a week before, the police commissioner, right, when he was interviewed, now these cops are being interviewed every day, right? I was watching the news and he said, well, the way we're going to catch this guy is if we get lucky and get him, and if the guy gets a parking ticket. That was in the papers too. Just as the commissioner says that we'll probably get him by the guy getting careless or something and getting a parking ticket or getting a ticket. A week later, they got him.
Ouroboros, the snake eats its tail.
He was great at taking credit for other people's ideas after the fact. It's entirely plausible that he did suspect that that ticket was going to be ultimately what would lead them to him. But even then, he took no effort to conceal himself. Knowing that he saw them writing the ticket, he could have got in the car and left the area without committing a crime. He had intentionally parked in an area where that he knew he could be ticketed, because that was one more way of getting close to the line of being caught without actually giving himself in. It was a way of trying to leave another track in the trail that he was convinced someday had to lead them, despite all the confusion and the police incompetence and everything else. So now you have a ticket linked to a crime that he intentionally committed after knowing the ticket was written, nor after hearing the police commissioner say that will probably be a parking ticket that leads to our taking this guy down, did he attempt to cover his tracks by destroying evidence. If anything, he left even more things in plain sight during that week or 3 week period, including his supposed plan to go commit that mass murder grand finale.
Act 4, the final funeral. By 4:50 a.m., the morning after the shooting, while doctors attempted to save Stacy Moskowitz's life, every camera crew in New York City was out in the hall trying to catch a glimpse. Officer Connie Jacobs recalls the scene, quote,
"My sergeant told me to keep the corridor clear for other emergency cases. It was impossible. Every time we'd clear it, a doctor or nurse would walk out into the hall and everyone would rush towards them with a barrage of questions. I must have been on 1,000 feet of film that morning."
But reporters weren't the only ones there. Stacy's mother, Nasa Moskowitz, was there too, saying later, quote,
"I parted the curtain and stepped inside. I walked directly to her. One eye was terribly swollen and puffed. The eyelid was an ugly purple. There was so much blood."
Still conscious, Stacy cried as she held her mother's hand, saying, quote,
"Mommy, it hurts so much. Please, Mommy."
And that was one of the last things she ever said. Stacy Moskowitz died at 5:22 p.m. on August 1st, 1977, just 38 hours after the attack. Her date, Bobby Violante, lost his left eye and had 20% vision in his right, making him legally blind. The bullet that had hit his eye had hit Stacy first, eventually taking her life. Quote, when I found out about me, how badly I was hurt, it really didn't register. It was hard to react because of all of the dope they were pumping into me. But I was awake and alert when I found out about Stacy, and that was the worst. It was something I knew I would have to live with forever, end quote. A few days later, the funeral of Stacy Moskowitz was broadcast on live TV.
Berkowitz did not attend the funerals of his victims in person. He just stayed home and watched it on television, because after every shooting, at this point, there was going to be incredible sensationalist coverage in all of the media, and the same with the funerals.
On my last two victims, that Moskowitz girl, and the reporters used to stay made a camp outside their house. They lived in a small garden apartment in the suburb, in the end of Brooklyn. The reporters camped outside their house. Because since that crime, it was 10 days before I got caught. It was still another 10 days after I got the parking ticket. And I used to watch the TV, and there was nothing but news. And they followed them. The reporters, you could see them following the victims when they buried her, in New Jersey. It was right next door to my mother's cemetery. The reporters followed the caravan of mourners, stood by the grave as she was being buried, and watching the coffin get lowered into the grave,
How did you feel watching that on TV?
It was, I knew it was over. I felt punishment was coming, I looked at the picture, I said, geez, look at that guy, he deserves to get caught, when are they going to catch him, The more I saw all that, the more I wanted to get caught once and for all.
Watching the funeral of his final victim on television, David Berkowitz thought only of himself. In the days following the attack, chaos, panic, and fear spread like inky tendrils throughout the city. The story was hot as hell, and it was impossible to control the press. The newspapers went nuts, and at least three newspaper journalists printed appeals to the murderer to turn himself in directly to them, rather than to authorities. It was total chaos. At one point, 100 people pulled the driver of a yellow bug out of his car after he yelled at two girls, because they had heard that a yellow bug had been spotted leaving the scene of the Moskowitz murder. Detective Sergeant Shea said, quote, things were getting hairy. You could feel it building. It was a giant pressure cooker, and you didn't want an explosion, end quote. In short, people were losing it. And it wasn't just Queens and the Bronx anymore. After the Moskowitz murder, it was citywide, all five boroughs. Now you could get shot anytime, anywhere. Next time on Killer Tape. Feeling capture was near, David Berkowitz plans a final grand gesture in the form of a mass shooting on a beach in Long Island.
My anger and hostilities would have dissipated for a short period of time, enough to get by for another month or something, but it didn't happen, so I sat there on the beach alone, feeling like an outsider, and became angry. It had a negative effect.
You didn't have the mental leave in your pocket or something?
No, it was in the car. I guess, it's a beach in the middle of summer at 90 degrees. You can't walk around with a big coat,
Was this the 44 or the
Well, it was a 44, but I had the rifle in the car,
Thanks for listening to Killer Tape, the true crime podcast where killers and hardcore criminals tell their own story in their own words. Killer Tape is written and produced by me, documentary filmmaker Bill Badgley, as well as veteran prison reporter Jack Jones. Additional writing and producing by Allison Baker. Executive producers include Jared Gutstadt, Jimmy Jelinek, and Phil Alberstadt. Research assistance by Olivia Pepper. Transcription services provided by Laura Klein Shaw. Editing and sound design by Molasses Manifesto Productions. Original score by Ben Von Wildenhaus. Artwork by Mike Gabriel. Kill a Tape is based on 19 hours of audio recorded with David Berkowitz inside Attica Prison in March of 1980 by veteran prison reporter Jack Jones. Additional resources for the series include Confessions of Son of Sam by David Abrahamson, M.D. and Son of Sam by Lawrence D. Klausner. Special thanks to Christian Bernhardt, Shelby Shankman at UTA. Stay safe out there.